Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In recent weeks, Israel has been rocked by violent conflict between Palestinians and Israelis. It has been some of the worst violence there in 4 years. It spread from Jerusalem to other places around Israel as well. The fighting began after a visit by Ariel Sharon, the leader of Israel's opposition party, the Likud, a visit to a site that was considered to be both sacred to Muslims and Jews, and a place that has been contested by both. The dispute over control of the site has been one of the contributing factors to a stalemate in the Arab-Israeli the Arab-Palestinian peace talks. Now, for the first time in almost 2 weeks, violence has begun to die down, but there remain some very significant questions about where the peace talks go from here and whether or not outside parties like the United States or the United Nations can help get the two sides back to the table and talking once again. This morning, we're going to try to talk a little bit about what has happened over the past couple of weeks and take stock of where things stand. And for that, we will be turning to Nathan Brown. He's professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University. He also is a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and has for a long time been following politics in this part of the world, the Arab-Israeli peace process, Palestinian politics, and has done a lot of research in the Middle East. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, we certainly want to invite people who are listening to be a part of the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455 or WILO, same either way, and toll-free 800-222-9455. You're welcome to join the conversation. Ask questions, make comments. All we ask of callers is that you please do try to be brief, because that way you're making room for others, and we do want to include as many people as would like to be a part of the conversation. Again, 333-WILO. Toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Professor Brown, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Sure.
I want to go back just for a moment to the event that seemed to have touched off this fighting that we've now seen for a couple of weeks, when Mr. Sharon made his visit to the Temple Mount, or Haram al-Sharaf, depending on who you are and its significance. And I was very struck by a comment in one of the stories that I made, and this was a sort of a person-on-the-street kind of comment, but it struck me as being fairly accurate, that at the time and afterwards there was a lot of finger-pointing going on at Mr. Sharon, saying, well, this was his fault. And yet the comment of this person was, well, yes, Mr. Sharon struck the match, but everything had already been soaked in gasoline. So it does indeed make one suspect that that almost here was a conflict just ready to erupt, and all it took was some action, and this just happened to be it. Is that the way you see this?
I think that's essentially correct, and one of the interesting things is that one of the very few things that Israeli and Palestinians seem to agree on is that the Sharon visit, you know, whether it was as provocative as the Palestinians claim or not, was simply the spark. And I've seen that exact word used both in the Israeli press and in the Palestinian press. That said, I think the ferocity of the response and the extent of the violence took both sides by surprise, probably the Israelis by surprise more than the Palestinians. But although it was, everybody recognized it was a tense situation, nobody expected this extent of violence or this length of violence.
Hmm. Well, does that say that in the peace process that perhaps the easy things have been done, and now the difficulty is that indeed we've come to the most difficult issues, and this one is among the most difficult of the most difficult?
Yes, I think that's one thing that it does say. I mean, the specific place that Sharon visited is the most sharply contested site between Israelis and Palestinians. That said, the grievances that both sides have go an awful lot deeper than simply this site within Jerusalem's old city. For the Palestinians, they claim that the peace process, which has been going on now essentially since 1993, has brought them no tangible benefits, or that the liabilities far outweigh the benefits. And for the Israelis, they claim that the Palestinian commitment to continuing the peace process has been brought into question.
I'm one of the things that certainly struck me as I was reading back over some of the reporting on this or that came over the last couple of weeks was the story about the meeting that took place between Mr. Arafat and Mr. Barak. And I believe this was maybe 2 days before Sharon made his visit to the Temple Mount. And the story was that Mr. Arafat had actually gone to Mr. Barak's home and met with him there. And the stories were that this was the best meeting these men had ever had. Now, and I guess I'm also wondering how it is that one, and now, based on what's happened in the past couple of weeks, they're not speaking directly with one another. They're only speaking through intermediaries. How in the space of 2 weeks does one go from the best meeting we've ever had to not talking to each other?
Well, again, it depends on which side you talk to. For the Israelis, some Israeli officials, even within the more dovish Labor Party, will say that they're wondering whether the Palestinian leadership was really committed to the peace process all along. The Palestinian version of events is extremely different. Not only, they would claim, did the Israeli government allow Sharon to make this provocative visit, they sent him up there with an overwhelming police presence that was a defiant show of force to the Palestinians. And then when the immediate visit itself by Sharon was on a Thursday, there was very little violence associated with that. It was the next day when when Muslims gathered on the site for weekly prayers that some violence began, and Palestinians claimed the Israelis overreacted, killing a number of the Palestinian demonstrators and sort of setting off some Palestinian responses that then generated, according to the Palestinians, disproportionate Israeli responses.
One of the things that I have heard from people speaking for the Israeli government here now over the last week or more is that sort of their position that Yasser Arafat could end the violence that is on the Palestinian side, could end the violence merely with a word, merely by saying so. And I wonder, both in both cases here, when we talk about violence by Palestinians, violence maybe perpetrated by Israelis, whether indeed on both sides, Mr. Arafat, Mr. Barak, indeed have either of them have that kind of influence over people on both sides, and whether in fact part of the difficulty is that for both of them, there. We expect them to be able to make promises that they actually aren't in a position to make, because on their individual sides, the people are not all of one mind, and that perhaps there continue to be people who are actually opposed to the peace process.
Yeah, there is no doubt that the two sides have completely lost control of the leadership. I shouldn't say has completely lost control, but has lost control of events. I wouldn't go so far as to say that neither side has any control, however, over their side. In a sense, we're dealing with a disproportionate situation or an unequal situation. The Israelis have an army. They have security forces that are involved in these clashes. And they are operating under Barak's orders. Some of the Palestinians would claim they're operating under orders that give them a too free permission to use force, or that don't rein in those who use excessive force. In the last few days, however, what we've seen on the Israeli side is increasingly Israeli citizens from both within the 1967 borders of Israel and Israeli settlers on the West Bank and in Gaza themselves involved in some of the violence. So there's some evidence that perhaps the Israeli government is losing control a little bit. On the Palestinian side, the claim that Yasser Arafat could stop this with a word is clearly untrue, and Israeli officials have backed off of that statement. If you read press accounts carefully, they'll say he needs to send a clear signal, but even then it might take 48 hours. Palestinian society they have some of the trappings of the state of a state, but they're not really a state. Some of the organizations that have been involved in organizing Palestinian demonstrations and stone throwing and even some of the shooting from the Palestinian side are very loosely controlled organization that operates under Arafat's political party, but is perfectly capable of taking independent action. We saw that a few months ago, the Palestinian city of Ramallah, where rival militias essentially brought the town to a complete halt, and we're fighting wars with each other. If Arafat could control these forces so easily, they never would have happened. That said, Arafat has been extremely silent. It would take far more than a word from him to stop the violence or to stop Palestinian demonstrations and stone throwing. It would take concerted action on his part. But if you follow his statements in the Palestinian press, he's been virtually silent the entire time, and that's taken by most as a tacit endorsement or at least an acceptance of what's going on. I think that part is accurate, but the idea that he could stop it overnight or with a word is something that Israelis aren't even saying anymore.
How you pointed to the fact that this conflict the initial conflict, which began involving Israelis and Israeli military forces and Palestinians in Israel, Jerusalem, spilled over into other cities and started to involve other people. And now, particularly, Israeli Arabs have been involved to the extent that they have not before, at least according to some of the accounts that I have seen, in the sense that. Well, in the past, there have been attacks by Arabs against Jews inside Israel. Some people at least say that they can't remember a time when there has been so much violence by Jews, by Israelis, against Arabs inside Israel, and has led some people to start using the term civil war, if not to describe what was going on, then to suggest where things might lead. Is that, do you think, an accurate description, at least, that we're seeing here a kind of a conflict and a scope of conflict that we haven't seen before?
Yes. I mean, civil war, thank goodness, is still going a little bit too far, but we're clearly seeing violence of a sort that we haven't seen since 1948 in the war over the creation of the State of Israel that involves similar kinds of violence. There has been, growing political activity by Arab citizens of Israel. They've been increasingly vocal. There have been occasionally violent incidents in the past, the most extensive being in 1976, but they were completely unconnected or largely unconnected with what was going on between Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. During the Palestinian uprising, which began in 1990, at the end of 1996 and petered out in the early 1990s, there was virtually no echo. There may have been some sympathy, but there was virtually no echo among Israeli citizens who are Arab. This is a new dimension, and I would add it's probably a new dimension that is the most shocking element of this for Israeli Jewish citizens. Because whatever happens on the West Bank doesn't really affect the daily lives of most Israeli Jews. But roads have been closed, major arteries have been closed within inside Israel, cities have been engulfed in Arab-Jewish rioting, again in a way that hasn't been seen since 1948. All of a sudden this has been brought home, and there's no way any Israeli can escape the violence this time.
President Clinton has been trying to organize a quick sort of a a summit to bring the two sides together and get them talking again. He apparently suggested at one point perhaps that Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, could be the host for this. And it seems as if fairly quickly Mr. Mubarak said no, that basically the Palestinians, the Israelis, they got to get some things worked out among themselves beforehand. And one maybe couldn't blame them for not wanting to wade into this. How does this look indeed to other Arab governments? And is there some role for them to be involved? Or should we expect, like Mr. Mubarak, perhaps that they would just as soon not get into this?
Well, the Egyptians government has not stayed aloof from this. I wouldn't go that far. They did invite Arafat and Barak to meet in Egypt last week. Barak was reportedly disgusted by Arafat's behavior in Paris when they had met earlier and refused to go on to Egypt. And I think that probably led to some Egyptian indignation and a decision that if the Israelis don't want to come when they're invited, they're not going to invite them a second time. But the role of the Arab world in this more broadly beyond Egypt has been very interesting. There's no doubt that there's sort of broad sympathy in the Arab world for the Palestinians, for the Palestinian cause. But it's been a very, very quiet support for the last, certainly since 1990 and the Gulf War, when the Arab world was badly split over the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, and the Palestinians were identified by many with siding with Iraq. So a lot of those who'd sided with Kuwait still harbor grudges against the Palestinians for that. That has been largely forgotten in the last couple of weeks, and Arabs, even in places like Kuwait, which is one of the places in the Arab world where there's the most anti-Palestinian sentiment, even Kuwaitis have begun to rally behind Palestinians. In a sense, what this has done has been to make it, I think, more difficult for governments like the Americans that are trying to bring the two sides together, because Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian leadership is enjoying broader Arab support than it's had, for at least a decade, and in some ways you could even say for two decades.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Nathan Brown. He's professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University. He is also a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. And we're talking here about where things stand in the peace process and the talks between Israelis and Palestinians in view of the recent conflict and violence that's taken place over about the last 2 weeks. We have a few callers here. We'll get to them and would welcome others. Again, now the lines are full. I must really ask that people do try to be brief. We want to give everybody a chance and keep things moving along. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We'll start in Bloomington, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, sir.
Yes.
I have believed for the last 45 years that there never will be peace in the Middle East as long as Israel is there. Can you reassure me in some way?
I'm not sure that I can. A lot depends on what you mean by peace. Despite the events of the last 2 weeks, I think that the possibility for some Israeli-Palestinian agreement is still very much alive. It's obviously been obscured in the last couple weeks, and the events of the last couple weeks will make achievement of that agreement extremely difficult. It already was difficult, even more difficult. But I don't think it erases it. That said, when such an agreement is reached, if it is reached, it won't be some sort of messianic vision where Arabs and Jews forget the differences that have divided them for the last century. It will be a very reluctant peace, probably even more on the Palestinian side than on the Israeli side. So I would expect it to be a peace filled with tension, with even occasional violence, not on the scale that we're seeing today, but still a real peace that allows both societies to concentrate on their own internal problems. So I think that is still possible, but it won't be, as I say, some deep-seated historical reconciliation. Neither side will forget the history. They might just agree to move beyond it.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. We'll go to another caller here. This is Freeport, line 4. Hello? Caller there, line 4.
Yes. Did you happen to see the program last night on ABC? They had a what they called a town meeting from Jerusalem with Arabs and Jews on each side of the controversy.
I didn't see it, no. I did read some of the news accounts of it, but I didn't watch it myself.
Yes, well, the Palestinian woman legislator that was there made the point that the Jews, the Israelis, as you call them, are occupying Arab land. And this basic, what they came in and took the land away from them, and the killing of the Arab kids, 15, 16-year-old kids, by police and army has really exacerbated things. And she told the Jews, Israelis, point blank, to leave. Leave the territory. Get out. And, you know, the Arabs perceive the Jews there as puppets of the Western powers. Israel is a sort of a watchdog state in the Middle East to protect the Western imperialist oil interests there. And this this situation is due to Western expansion and so on. And now there's reports Saudi Arabia and some of the other Arab states, Syria and so on, will become involved if actions against Palestinians don't cease by the Israeli army and police.
Well, Professor Brown, you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that the person that you're referring to is Hanan Ashrawi, who is probably one of the most forceful presenters of the Palestinian cause. And that's probably encapsulates, in a nutshell, exactly what the Palestinian analysis of the last couple of weeks is, that it comes against a background of essentially the a failure to come to terms, to completely come to terms with the demands, with Palestinian national aspirations. The last part, in terms of getting the Saudis and the Syrians involved and the possibility of some broader war breaking out, I think that is unlikely. I do not think that it is unlikely that these states will come into give very strong diplomatic support to the Palestinians, however, in a way that will make compromise perhaps more difficult.
Let's continue. We'll go next to another caller, and I believe that this will be line number 2 in Bloomington, Indiana. Hello.
Hi. Could I just ask you two quick questions? One about common justice and the other about the effects of appeasement. About simple justice, Israel is a country the size of our state of New Jersey. And the Arab Muslim lands collectively are 640 times the size of Israel. And yet the Muslims begrudge the Jews even this tiny little country of their own. And there's little doubt that if the Muslims ever win a war against the Jews, there is going to be another anti-Jewish Holocaust. There's just no doubt about that. What about common justice? The Jews deserve to have a land of their own.
I would say that that's, you know, of course, one of the strongest arguments for the existence of the State of Israel that you can make. But that's not the same as justifying any particular borders for that state. Essentially, what the current leadership of Israel maintains, and essentially this is the sort of left-leaning view, exemplified by people like Rabin and Barak, is that it is possible now to negotiate secure borders, and it will make Israel more secure to come to an agreement with the Palestinians that does allow some Palestinian state to emerge in the West Bank and Gaza. So at this point, the argument would go, this is not an argument about the existence of the State of Israel. That argument has been won by Israel. The argument is about its borders, and Israel can afford to withdraw from Palestinian-populated areas primarily because the alternatives are far worse, more destabilizing internationally and more destabilizing internally for Israel.
Yes, but determining those borders, it appears that Israel has been willing to give more to the Palestinians in the face of Palestinian hostility than it was almost inconceivable that the Israelis would actually consider giving parts of Jerusalem back to the Palestinians. I mean, I don't think that in history there has never been a nation more generous, a victorious. The Jews were victorious over the Palestinians. The Palestinians, while the Palestinians now are threatening their very existence, and they make no secret of it, the Jews have been willing to how shall we say, appease them. This is appeasement in spades. And look what look what the results have been. The results have been they're facing now a war, and if they lose this war, it's all over for them.
Yeah. I mean, that's essentially the counter-argument of the domestic opponents of the peace process in Israel, that what this is simply whetting Palestinian appetites. I will say that my reading of the Palestinian situation is far different, that the Palestinian leadership and most of the Palestinian population in the West Bank and Gaza have come to terms with the fact that the most that they will ever get will be a West Bank and Gaza state. That's the sort of thing that is routinely repeated in Palestinian newspapers that I read. That's what I hear in conversations with Palestinians. So I'm telling you my personal read of Palestinian society in the West Bank and Gaza. That is the sort of appeasement argument I don't find so convincing. When you get to Palestinians outside the West Bank and Gaza, there's much less willingness to concede that. But in terms of the Palestinians that are involved this particular round of fighting, that is what I think is involved.
Well, thank you very much for your answer.
All right, let's go to, again, another caller. That would be in Savoy, and that's line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. I wanted to ask you to comment on the United States' reaction to all of this, the United States government's reaction to all of this. We've seen, and you've mentioned, that there are now armed Jewish gangs. A lot of them are settlers, people who are living in illegally built settlements on the West Bank. Some of them are from Israel proper, and they are rampaging through Arab neighborhoods and Arab villages. Many of them, most of them, have guns. And it seems that the Israeli security forces have no problems with these people, the Jewish mobs. We don't hear about any Jewish rioters being shot or even injured or anything, and yet the Israeli forces are always right there, ready with guns drawn to shoot down little kids with rocks, but somehow they don't have a problem with these Jewish rioters rampaging through the streets and threatening people who are supposedly under the protection of the Israeli forces just as much as the Jewish citizens of Israel are. Why is it that the United States seems to be so solicitous of this behavior? Why is it the United States was so condemnatory of the UN attempts to pass resolution, and they even threatened to veto the resolution until it was watered down? Could you please comment on that?
Yeah, in terms of the situation in Israel, of what's going on, before I move on to the American policy, I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying, but my emphasis would be slightly different. I think the Israeli leadership is probably horrified by this violence. I think you're absolutely correct, and you know, we're both viewing this from afar, and we're both making educated guesses based on media reports, but I think my hunch is that you're correct, that the Israeli police and security forces are far more willing to use deadly force, against Palestinians, and whether on the West Bank and Gaza or Israeli citizens, than they are willing to use it against Israeli Jews. In terms of how the United States handles this, I mean, I think there's frenetic activity to try and preserve whatever chance there is of a final agreement. The feeling, I think, in the American government is that the United States came as close to a negotiated settlement between the Palestinians and the Israelis at Camp David as they've ever come, and they are so tantalizingly close that the pursuit of that goal has trumped almost all other concerns. The reaction in other governments, for instance, especially in Europe, has been very different and more sympathetic to the point of view that you're putting across. But as far as the Americans are concerned, I think that if there is criticism to be made of the Israeli government's behavior, it will be done in private. And in fact, there are some signs that that is exactly what has happened, that the Americans have pressured Barak very heavily to try and make Israeli police and security forces behave with a much more restraint. And as I read the situation, that pressure has had some effect over the last few days. So I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss the American efforts to work behind the scenes. I mean, their sort of line of not criticizing Israel in public or doing so only in fairly ginger terms, but pressuring in private does seem to have had some effect.
I'm very confused, though, about the attitude that we hear expressed about the praise for how flexible the Israelis have been and how they are the ones who are giving up so many things. If I understand correctly, the Israelis are in occupation of at least the West Bank and Gaza. This is a matter of international law that they are there illegally. They are building settlements there illegally. And yet it sounds like if somebody were to come and steal my car and then negotiate a deal to let me drive it on the weekends, I wouldn't praise that person for their flexibility and their generosity. I'd want my car back. Why is it that the United States is siding with the thief? Could you please explain that?
In terms of the American position, let me leave that aside for a second. But I think the point of view that you're putting across is a very good presentation of the Palestinian position, and this is why Palestinians were extremely frustrated after Camp David. When you're talking about concessions, it depends on where your starting point is. For the Israelis, they had made all these concessions from where they thought their starting point had been. They gave more than they had ever talked about giving in the past. And the Palestinian response was exactly as you say. What are you talking about these being concessions for? These are things that always belong to us by right. That's what makes the negotiations so extremely difficult. In terms of the United States, what I think if you look back almost since 1967, with a few exceptions, the American attitude has been that when negotiations were getting nowhere, why pick a fight with Israel over this? And when negotiations were getting somewhere, that the last thing that would do any good would be for the United States to come in and weigh in with its own position on this. That's not 100% what has happened in all the negotiations, but that's been a fairly consistent theme. So whether or not you agree with it, at least that's been the American thinking.
I'm going to jump in here off the caller. Will forgive me, but we're getting to the point where we have a little less than 15 minutes left, and I have a couple of other callers I want to get, and also want to again take the opportunity to introduce our guest in this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Nathan Brown. He is currently scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He is also professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University, and Middle East politics is his special area of interest. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Just for a second here, I would like to ask a question about what's going on in Israeli politics. And it certainly is the case that Mr. Barak's time as prime minister has been difficult for him and for his party. We seem to have a conflict brewing, if not already in full swing, for around the question of who is going to lead the Likud party. And then it looks very likely that we're going to have a contest over who's going to lead the government of Israel. How much of what's been going on here over the last couple of weeks really has to do with those issues and it's about Israeli domestic politics?
I don't think that, I mean, you're describing the Israeli political scene, domestic political scene, and its turmoil very, very well. But following Sharon's visit, which did have to do very much with Israeli domestic politics, one thing that has struck me is how separate these realms have been. Because many people pointed the finger of blame at Sharon, he was at first very defensive and very slow to criticize Barak. And second, I think he realized that there was a possibility of a national unity government. And third is, despite Sharon's flaws as Palestinians see them, and they go back for over a generation, he is an Israeli patriot. He saw his country in trouble, and he kept quiet. What's been more interesting to me has been Barak's reaction. Barak could turn around in a second and form a national unity government, bring in Sharon, bring in all sorts of other parties, and keeping his job. He has not done so. Just today he called for a national unity government, but it's clear that he's, at least up to this point, he's not willing to pay the price of abandoning the peace process in order to form that government. So that for the past 2 weeks, in spite of this violence, he hasn't been willing to cut his burn his bridges with the Palestinians, burn his bridges with the peace process. This is giving him all kinds of incredible domestic headaches. It's giving him, he's basically in a position where now he remains as prime minister only because the Knesset is not in session and can't vote him out, which it would do presumably when it would next meet at the end of the month if it could. So he's paid a tremendous domestic political price for this, and he seems to be, at least up to today, willing to continue to pay it.
Well, let's talk with some other folks. We have another Indiana caller on our line number one right here. Hello.
Yes, I would like to ask the question. We are scheduled to go to Israel for this coming 2 weeks. How wise is it for us to go on that tour, in your opinion?
I hate to give this kind of advice, so I won't tell you what you should do, but I will tell you what I would do if it were my tour and my group. And I'll say this based on the fact that I was just living in Israel for a year. I was living in Tel Aviv. I was doing research in Palestinian areas, so virtually all the flashpoints right now in the conflict are places where I was routinely going for the past year. Obviously, this is not the best time to go, but if it were me and my family and my young children, I would go. You'll find very few other tourists there, I would guess. But the places where there are violence are much more numerous than in the past, but they are avoidable. And there is, my guess is your tour operators will not be taking you to the old city. They will not be taking you to many of the holy sites that are unfortunately in areas where there is violence, but there is still places where calm does prevail, and my guess is they would be making the necessary arrangements. So if it were me and my family, I would go. I would go nervous, and I would go probably knowing that I was leaving nervous relatives and friends behind.
Yes.
But that's what I would do if I were in your place.
Okay, well, I appreciate that information. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to a caller here in Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Like a previous caller, the one before the last one, I feel very much the same way in that we seem to see one side. And when I mention the same thing to my Jewish friends and other people, I'm called anti-Semitic. And I say, wait a minute, I'm not anti-Semitic. I just think the nation of Israel has a few problems with their neighbors, and it doesn't seem fair. Now, that's just pretty much just a comment, but the thing I'd like to hear something from you about is that it seems that this problem could be at least partially solved if we took that very important part of the whole world where everybody seems to have some kind of religious connection and put it under an international thing, or, God forbid, get rid of it completely. Then nobody could have claim over it. But if we could solve that part of the problem, it seems the rest of it would fall a great deal apart. Am I right with that?
I think you're right that if you could solve that problem, a lot of the rest would fall into place. Internationalization would be a fairly difficult proposition to sell, essentially, to the Israelis. And I would go back to what I said earlier. What you consider a concession depends on what you think the starting point is. For the Israelis, the fact is they have control over these places, and their response would be, we maintain them, we keep them, we keep open access to them. We have proven our ability to do this, and we don't trust internationalization, as was originally proposed back in 1947 by the UN plan. I think the Palestinians would be a little bit more friendly to the idea of internationalization. I don't think the idea is completely dead, and the Americans seem to have been trying to explore some kind of internationalization, not of all of Jerusalem, but of specific points within Jerusalem, and getting some limited progress with both the Palestinians and the Israelis on that.
I take slight exception with you there, sir, in that the Palestinians keep it open. I mean, the Israelis keep it open for who they want it to be open for. They don't really keep it open for the Palestinians the way that the Palestinians would like it to be open, obviously.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I was simply talking about how the Israelis present their position.
Yes, I see that. And then also, you know, we do a lot for the Israelis. And the rest of the world helps out in the whole area there. Surely international policy could finally put so much pressure to bear on this, say, look, you're either going to get along or you're going to have to get out. You know what I mean? It just seems there ought to be some answer to this problem.
I think the answer is actually, we're much closer to an answer than may initially appear. I mean, I made reference to being there in the past year, and a lot of my work took me to various places in Jerusalem, and the situation in Jerusalem is a lot different on the ground than the sloganeering of both sides would lead you to believe. The fact is that there are Palestinian neighborhoods in Jerusalem that are virtually ruled by the Palestinian Authority right now. If you go into the schools, they're studying Palestinian Authority textbooks. The Palestinian police are there. People, if they have disputes, they don't call in the Israeli police or don't bring them to the Israeli courts. They'll bring them to Palestinian officials. And the Israelis know that this is going on in these neighborhoods. And to tell you the truth, don't really care that much about it. They do care about the issue of sovereignty, but when it comes to managing municipal affairs in these neighborhoods, they don't really manage them that well, and they're not really that attached to them. So when you get to the real sticking points, you're really talking about a fairly small area, not all of Jerusalem, not even all of Arab Jerusalem, but the old city of Jerusalem, and actually not even all of the old city, and a few surrounding neighborhoods. That's where the sticking point really is. And so it's a lot smaller, and I actually think that if you had two sides who were absolutely committed to a settlement, you could probably come to some mutually acceptable arrangement. That's why I think it's so frustrating for the United States right now, because that's where they thought they were a couple of weeks ago before everything blew up.
Mm. Let's take another caller here. We summoned on a car phone. This is line two. Hello?
Yes. Some of the callers seem to suggest that Israel should be removed somehow. And they forget that Israel has also a claim to that land. If all land conquered in warfare were to be given back, then the United States would probably give back much of the Southwest to Mexico. I mean, we could go around the world and do this. I mean, Israel is willing to negotiate and try to get some kind of a settlement there. That's a comment. The question is, rapidity and the many places in which the uprising, Palestinian uprising arose, doesn't it seem that it was not spontaneous, but that it was organized? What is your opinion on that?
To be honest, I'm not sure it makes that much difference to the Israelis. If it was spontaneous, that means they're dealing with a difficult peace partner. And if it was organized, it means they're dealing with a difficult peace partner. I would also say that I wouldn't draw a sharper distinction between the two. There was clearly an awful lot of Palestinian resentment and a widespread feeling deep within Palestinian society that the peace process had not only brought few benefits, but had actually cost Palestinians a considerable amount in terms of movement, in terms of economic levels, and so on. So that it wouldn't take much organization or much more, I think, than a green light from the leadership to set something like this off. I would also say that looking again at this from afar and looking primarily at Palestinian media which are more independent than they often get credit for being, but still would not go too far from the official line, that it's clear that the violence does, or the Palestinian, I would say the Palestinian demonstrations, the rock throwing and so on, does have very strong official endorsement. There definitely is that green light.
I want to try and get one more caller here, Champaign County, line number three. Hello?
Hi. Too much to say, but just one point that you made is you said that Israelis no longer accuse Arafat. Well, that's just not true. That was done last night on that chat show or town meeting that was done. And we have in people at the Congress in our level passing a resolution condemning Arafat for virtually the same, and we have the Secretary of State crediting him with that language. I'm not quite so sure of, but the implication is that he was precipitating it. So I think what you're saying is that in the Barak government, people are giving up on that, but that doesn't cover all of the Israelis and all of the different factors that are going on. And the Sharon thing seems that Sharon was provoked by the Netanyahu threat. To my mind, that's that when you were asked the question about the internal dynamics, that's what I thought of. Is Netanyahu was acquitted, or the case was not pushed forward in some sense or another. So that's the dynamics there. I don't know how to sum up, but I just wanted to point out that from the very beginning of the show, and I don't want to be too critical of Mr. Eng, but he introduced the show as a discussion of violence in Israel, which I think proves the point that the whole construct is that this is that presumes the resolution of the case. East Jerusalem, whether it's de facto under Palestinian Authority, I mean, it's de facto not under their sovereignty because of the way people view it here. And I think that was just an indicator of that. And I guess there's only a minute or so for you to say anything about any of those three things. But thanks for the show.
Sure. Well, go ahead, Dr. Brown.
Well, let me pick up on the last point and probably avoid responding directly since I wasn't the one who titled the show. But I think the problem of terminology illustrates, as well as anything else could, exactly how difficult this conflict is. It is impossible to refer to the location in Jerusalem in a way that both sides, for instance, the Temple Mount or El Haram al-Sharif, you cannot say that or refer to that place without seeming to take sides. You can't refer to the capital of Israel without appearing to take sides. For a long time, it's no longer the case, you couldn't refer to the term Palestinian without appearing to take sides. That's what makes it so difficult. I would still add, go back to sort of what I hope has been sort of a hopeful theme throughout some of my remarks, is that the two sides, despite their extremely deep differences, do seem to me to be on the verge of a settlement. And the events of the last 2 weeks have made that much more difficult and probably pushed back the date of any possible settlement. But I still think that they are closer than they have ever been since the very beginning of this conflict, early in the 20th century, to finally coming up with not a wonderful and final peace, but at least a manageable peace. And I would still expect that to break out, not necessarily this year, not even necessarily next year, but within the next few years.
Well, we'll have to stop there because we've used our time with the promise, I'm sure, that in the future we'll be talking about it again. But for the moment, we have to say to you, Dr. Brown, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Our guest, Nathan Brown, professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University. Broadcast of our show, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. In the next part of Focus, we'll talk about American politics, looking back to the election of 1948, in which Harry Truman was elected, re-elected. Well, he was elected president. We'll talk with Zachary Carabel about his book, The Last Campaign,